From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor at CNN Digital, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. China devalued its currency, rattling international stock markets and deepening worries about a slowdown in the world's second largest economy. At the same time, two horrific explosions tore apart a giant warehouse storing hazardous chemicals in the port city of Tianjin, killing more than 50 people and raising new questions about China's industrial safety standards. In Iraq, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi got parliamentary approval for a series of steps to streamline his government and reduce corruption. Iraq faces multiple challenges, including a growing threat from the group that calls itself the Islamic State. In the United States, the debate about the Iran nuclear agreement continued to heat up in advance of a congressional vote in September. Two prominent former Republican officials, Brent Scowcroft and John Warner, came out in support of the deal. The Obama administration is trying to woo others, including Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. He was invited to accompany Secretary of State John Kerry on a trip to Cuba, where the United States has restored formal diplomatic relations. And finally, in domestic U.S. politics, despite comments that many saw as vulgar and sexist, businessman Donald Trump continues to lead the polls for the Iowa caucus for the Republican presidential nomination. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, the presumptive frontrunner for the Democratic nomination, is facing a surprisingly stiff challenge in New Hampshire from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Tim, we're going to start with China. Not a good week, and a lot of developments that are very concerning, I think, to folks in the international economic field. What does this devaluation mean for U.S. exports, for U.S. imports? What does it mean for interest rates, all sorts of things going forward?
Yeah, well, I think China's having this internal deliberation about the degree to which market forces need to play a role in their economy, whether the government can step in and regulate issues of safety, which is, I think, an issue that will come up after this Tianjin explosion, whether it can regulate the price of its currency. It looks this week to be decreasing the value of the currency, which means that it'll be cheaper to buy Chinese products, making American goods more expensive in comparison, making American exports more difficult in the competitive field. So what does that mean? I think the Chinese are really looking at a deep vulnerability in the system. You see a dramatic decline in the Chinese stock market, exposing a lot of these holes in this model that the Chinese government has long tried to hold to, which is a very tight control over their economy. That probably can't sustain itself in the long term, especially if China wants to continue to grow at the rate that it has been.
Yeah, I read an interesting piece on the Brookings Institution website by a guy named Douglas Elliott. He was talking about the weaknesses of the Chinese stock market. As you know, Hillary, it went way up, and then it went way down this year. And it talked about the fact that, you know, there's no transparency about these stock markets or about the overall structure of Chinese businesses. So it's very difficult, really, for shareholders to know what they're buying into. And it kind of it leads to speculation and bubbles and then abrupt corrections like the one that we saw. To my mind, I agree with Tim. I think it's a question not just of Chinese economic evolution, but it's political evolution. Can you really have a Chinese model which is based on continuing economic growth without giving people some understanding of the underlying factors, you know, who's in charge and how decisions are made?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, that opaqueness means that whenever you see these types of disruptions, they can have much larger reverberations internationally because people don't have any confidence that even the bad information that's coming out is actually the true extent of how bad the information is. So when you see stocks to decline, it can lead to more rapid sell-off. There's just less confidence, and it raises questions, which is going to be a threat for China. It might be able to manage its own people, but it's going to be much less effective managing the rest of the world. But it's also a real vulnerability internally because it also means that when bad things happen, it's not simply a bad national event that people have to weather, but it's a cause for real questions about the political system. What, you know, distrust of government, what they're telling people, why bad things are happening. Is it because of corruption? Is it in terms of, you know, internal controls that are not in the best interest of the people? Which is why when you see in Tianjin this explosion, which is a total human and environmental disaster, it also becomes a political issue. Mm-hmm. Because now the government has to worry about how angry the people are going to be because they don't have outlets for expressing their concerns, for feeling that there's going to be a responsive government and regulations and appropriate treatment of these kinds of things. So I think that there's a real question mark about the duration of mm-hmm. the way the Chinese government has been proceeding.
Yeah. In terms of this Tianjin thing, I mean, this is just horrific. If you saw the pictures, you know, there was an entire parking lot of cars that had sort of been reduced to kind of charred cinders. And apparently firemen were allowed to go in before it was safe. And as a result, something like, 40 firemen were killed. The warehouses were far too close to residential areas. So, of course, all these windows were blown out. A lot of people were killed or injured because of breaking glass. And apparently since April, there have been at least 5 large explosions at chemical plants in cities. So, yeah, okay, Communist Party runs the show, Tim, but at what point do Chinese just say, you know, this is impossible, we can't continue to have this? And we haven't even mentioned the horrible chemicals now that have been spewed into the air and into the sea and into the ground.
Right. I mean, this is the sort of accident you'd imagine seeing in early 20th century America or India in its earlier stages of development. I mean, these are the mm-hmm. sorts of questions that countries that are on the rise economically need to answer, which is how do we send firemen into an industrial area when there's a big explosion? How do we create these safeguards to ensure that our people are safe? Create regulations that, while might stifle the activities of some local economies, will save people and mm-hmm. save lives in the long term. And for all the fears the United States and some in the West have of China as a competitor or an antagonist, they're still going through a lot of growing pains. And they're still a developing economy that needs to deal with these very basic questions, political and economic and regulatory, about how to prevent people from dying in these what we imagine are simple questions.
Yeah. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Hillary Krieger and Tim Mack. Just one last point, Hillary, on the China explosions. Initially, the Chinese allowed people to take pictures, allowed them to go on social media and so on. But then there was an effort to kind of clamp down, and apparently an online database that lists Tianjin companies became unavailable, so people could not find out more about the owner of the warehouse, Ruhai International Logistics. So once again, we sort of see this tension. I mean, how much can they control? How much can they not control?
Right. And I think there, you know, part of what we are seeing is a somewhat of a shift in the Chinese government in terms of, you know, there are different arguments about why they're devaluing the currency, but there is some indications that it's to try and be a little bit more responsive to the market and not as tightly controlled. And at first, with this explosion, you saw signs of openness. There was a press conference about it, which is highly unusual. There was, an ability for people to be talking in social media, et cetera. But it's one tendency in other competing tendencies and motivations within the government. And I think that's something they haven't resolved themselves. And when you see, you know, giving one inch and then taking 10 back. So yeah. I think there's an ongoing tension about how, because of all the questions of whether what they're doing is sustainable, how can they, you know, modulate it in a way that still gives them ultimate control and also doesn't create a lot of instability by making a rapid mm-hmm. change.
All right. We're going to turn to another country that has even worse problems, Tim, and that's Iraq. The Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, took some steps recently to try to streamline the government, deal with complaints about corruption. There have been demonstrations in the streets of Baghdad, even though it's, you know, well over 110 degrees in August, against corruption, against all the various layers of bureaucracy. I mean, Iraq apparently is, I think, one of the most corrupt places on earth on the Transparency International roster of corruption. I think they're sixth from the bottom, which is pretty depressing. So an effort now is being made to get rid of some vice presidents, show that he's really in charge. Do you think it's going to work? Do you think it's going to lure more Sunnis back? Do you think it's going to increase his popularity?
Well, I mean, many efforts like this have been tried.
Well, this is the first by al-Abadi, I think, since he took over, you know.
Sure, but the sectarian tensions in Iraq are so deep, you wonder if these really marginal efforts to fend off corruption are really going to have a lasting effect, that the scars and the divisions between the Shia and Sunni populations and the Kurdish peoples in Iraq as well, whether they can really be dealt with, or a smaller issue like corruption. I mean, in Baghdad just this week, we saw a response to some of these proposed changes. That is, a car bomb went off in a Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad, killing dozens of people.
Well, I don't know if you can directly relate that to what.
Well, no, I mean, but it's. I mean, these are the competing narratives. One is an issue of how do we streamline government and make it better. The other is violence.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know that anything Haider al-Abadi would do would stop ISIS from these kinds of attacks. I mean, that's questionable. He's trying to attract some level of support from Sunnis who are not Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, like Hillary, and that's a question. Can he do that?
But I think there is a greater question of his ability to govern and be seen as responsive to what, you know, people are demanding. And part of what he's doing with these anti-corruption moves is that people were coming out in the streets. There were these massive power outages. There were temperatures were over 120 degrees in some cases. And they're demanding, you know, the government take care of basic things. And I think that climate of violence does intensify the feeling the government is not, you know,
yes,
doing what
that
it needs to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so while these are gestures that might not trickle down to the places where corruption is, you know, most evident in people's daily lives, it certainly is high profile. It's certainly taking on the system in a way. And he got, you know, widespread support for it, which wasn't necessarily expected. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, Parliament approved it.
Right. So I think he's limited this the situation, the history, the loyalties of the different groups is, you know, these are huge forces he's up against, but he does, you know, he is in the space that he has taking some affirmative steps, which, you know, hasn't always been the path of leaders in these kinds of difficult situations. So I think it's a really interesting question what that brings and, you know, what more, you know, could be done if, you know, these types of steps aren't successful. So,
yeah. Tim, talking about about ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call it, Daesh, horrific new reports coming out. There was one in the New York Times about sex slavery of Yazidi women, which was just beyond belief, where they seem to think they're sanctioned by God to rape 12-year-olds. And now there's a report that they're using mustard gas, which apparently they picked up in Syria, brought across the border, and they're using it against Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in Iraq. I don't know, is this a sign of desperation or just their extreme brutality?
I mean, it's a continuation of ISIS's willingness to attack people without discriminating between combatants and civilians. That this has continued in forms that didn't involve mustard gas for a very, very long time. You know, it's the same question that we saw in Syria when there were those chemical weapons attacks. Assad's regime had killed many, many, many civilians at greater numbers through conventional means, but it didn't raise the world's attention. ISIS is now using mustard gas, and I could see it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, but it's regularly killing and attacking the Kurdish Peshmerga through conventional means and killing far greater numbers through conventional means, and it's bringing their violence all across Iraq and Syria in a way that should be noticed just as much.
Yeah. There are some reports that, Hillary, that U.S.-led or trained forces are preparing to maybe take back Ramadi in Iraq, but we've been hearing these reports and then nothing happens, and nobody talks about Mosul anymore, which seems to remain firmly in the hands of IS.
I think the, you know, the Pentagon wants people to think that they remain engaged, and the U.S. government has sort of taken a fits and starts approach to, well, there are certain airstrikes they'll do, and then there's certain, you know, when it comes to intelligence sharing with other groups that could take action, they're not going to do that. I mean, there's a lot of different weighing of trying to, A, do something against ISIS, but certainly seems to be not willing to concede ground to ISIS, balanced out against certain military measures that the White House in particular has not wanted to take. You actually saw the top outgoing Army general say this week that if things aren't getting better, the military should certainly consider the option of boots on the ground in terms of Americans embedding with Iraqis. That's something that the Obama administration has not wanted to do. So while you have this tug and pull going on in terms of what the best policy is, you hear a lot of talk. You know, there's an interest in projecting American power and projecting American engagement, but then you don't always see the action on the ground.
Yeah, this is Ray Odierno. He also suggested that Iraq might split into three, which was not something that either the Iraqis or the administration really wanted to hear at this point. I wanted to move on and just talk briefly about the Iran debate, which continues surprisingly into August, even after Congress has gone out of session, and just mention that we are beginning to see some interesting hints of bipartisanship, Tim. A couple of moderate Republicans, statesmen, former officials, Brent Scowcroft and John Warner, also I believe Dick Lugar, now have come out in support of the Iran nuclear agreement, and they've said basically that if it doesn't go through, it's going to be a blow to U.S. credibility and diplomacy if the unity of the international community was broken over this. And of course, we had Chuck Schumer on the Democratic side come out against. So is it too much to hope that some people might actually vote on this according to their conscience? Or is it just going to be a kind of political stalemate?
No, you know, I'm as cynical as they come, and I think that these lawmakers...
You're too young to be cynical.
I'm as cynical as I can be for my age. And,
okay.
I think that these lawmakers are really viewing this as a moral vote, a vote of conscience, and they're individually reflecting on how best to view the Iran deal. I think Chuck Schumer looked at it and said, hey, I'm going to vote against it. I think the same could be said of... you know, the Republicans who may be considering it, like Senator Jeff Flake, who is considering voting for the Iran deal. So I think that there's bipartisanship on both sides.
Yeah. It'd be good to see more of it. Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with Hillary Krieger and Tim Mack. Tim, you mentioned Jeff Flake. Hillary, a very important event in terms of outreach to another difficult country is taking place, and that is the raising of a U.S. flag over the U.S. embassy in Havana, Cuba. Jeff Flake was invited to come along by John Kerry. How significant a moment is this?
I think symbolically it's very significant because it really is, unlike the Iran deal, which is more important, I think, in terms of international relations, this has a much more colorful image. It gives you a picture, something that's much more tangible and concrete and also definitive about what's happening, in keeping with Obama's orientation towards the rest of the world of reaching out to adversaries, of making deals and finding ways to work together. And I think nothing, you know, symbolizes that more than after decades of hostility between Cuba and the United States, that he's found a way to reestablish diplomatic relations capped by this reopening of the U.S. embassy, sending John Kerry at a very high level to do that. And certainly in terms of his, you know, the orientation towards Latin America and signaling that he's listening to Latin American countries that have long been, you know, concerned about the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba that's really been problematic for the region. You had the Pope say that it was important that the two sides, you know, find a way to reestablish relations and in keeping with that sort of humanistic and multilateral spirit. This mm-hmm. is something that, you know, is very important in terms of that legacy. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the practicalities, Cuba is a, you know, place that Americans would like to go for vacation more.
Mm-hmm. Looks certainly lovely, I must say. Looking
certainly
at the pictures.
I know the beaches must be very nice. The music. certainly for, you know, for Cubans, this could be a total game changer. But I think that, you know, it's going to be limited to that, you know, that sphere of action, as opposed to sort of the broader realignments that, you know, can happen when you have, say, an Iran nuclear deal on the table.
Yeah, well, obviously, an Iran nuclear deal is a little bit more momentous in strategic terms. Tim, any thoughts about Cuba, or should we move on to U.S. domestic politics?
Let's move on to U.S. domestic politics.
All right. Well, a lot going on, of course, some new polls have come out. There was the first Republican presidential debate, actually two of them, a junior varsity debate and then the big leagues. And some scrambling has occurred in the polls, but Donald Trump remains out there with more than 20% in the polls, at least as far as the Iowa caucuses are concerned. And this confuses me a lot because I always think of Iowa, particularly on the Republican side, as very conservative, very straight-laced, and yet the things that Trump has been saying are anything but.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is a man who, while he doesn't have a history of being conservative, speaks in a tone and a manner that pleases conservatives. That is, that he's willing to say things that I think conservatives are secretly thinking. Some conservatives are secretly thinking, and in a way that angers the establishment, the press, in a way that pleases those caucus goers in Iowa who might support him. It's not so much the things he says, it's the way he says them, and that's, I think, what appeals. He's had a long history of offensive comments, whether they relate to veterans or they relate to women, but that hasn't hurt his standing in the polls. In fact, he said a lot of things that would be major gaffes and scandals for any other candidate, would have destroyed any other campaign, but because Donald Trump has created this caricature of himself, has created this image of himself as you know, lofty and constantly bragging and ready to say offensive things, it doesn't hurt him because that's Donald Trump.
Hillary, what do you think? What's the appeal? I don't understand it.
It's really confusing because if you look at the types of people who support him, so there's what you're saying about Iowa, obviously a very large evangelical voting base, which prioritizes usually social issues, but also people who have compelling personal narratives, people of character, people who invoke, you know, God. Yeah. Also does very well with people who are out of work, sort of the white working class who've really been hurt by the economy. He's a billionaire. He doesn't seem to have particularly extensive plans for helping people in those situations. But I agree. I think it has to do with what he represents. He represents somebody who will take on the system, who will not be cowed, who is simply, the gloves are off and he's a straight talker. And I think he represents a lot of anger and frustration and anxiety. And I think for those people, having somebody who doesn't pull punches, that gives vent to that anger and frustration. However, I think, you know, we're talking about 6 months out of the first votes.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to say to a pollster, oh, I like Donald Trump. He's all over the place right now.
Yeah.
But when people start to actually vote, especially places like, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire particularly, where people take their votes very seriously, they see themselves as really winnowing the field. And one thing they do think about is electability. They are pragmatic in many ways. I think, you know, these numbers could change. Just because he's been sort of Teflon when it comes to the types of outrageous statements that can hurt other candidates, I don't know that he's Teflon when it comes to actual voting, when it comes to mobilizing people on the ground, when it comes to the actual, you know, get out the vote politics, and when it comes to people really casting a ballot. And another thing is those people who might be polling and saying they like him, it's not clear that they're the people that actually go to the caucuses.
To the caucuses to vote,
because there are a lot of people that might identify as Republican and therefore be part of these polls. The people who go to the caucuses and to primaries are a very small number. They're usually quite committed in terms of their party affiliation. Many of the people that like Trump are not. Mm-hmm. So it could be quite a big difference between what we're seeing in terms of this sort of resonance with a certain segment of the population versus the people that actually are going to be determining who the Republican candidate is, who are going to have other priorities in mm-hmm. mind. Mm-hmm.
Well, unbelievably, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, enterprise editor at CNN Digital, and Tim Mack, congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.